It's kind of crazy to think about, but we're living in a timeline where the nerds won. Fantasy isn't niche anymore. It's everywhere. It's a billion-dollar, board-approved, franchise-churning machine stretching across almost every medium, industry, and generation. And it kind of makes you wonder, how did we even end up here? So I want to ask you, yes, you, a question. What do you think is the single most influential fantasy series of all time? Go on, take a second. This is a safe space. 3, 2, 1, go. Okay, let's see what we got. I see Narnia, I see Conan the Barbarian, and a few contrarians chiming in with Discworld and Earthsea, which love to see it. But overwhelmingly, it looks like the winner is, to no one's surprise, The Lord of the Rings. And fair enough, you really can't talk about the birth of modern fantasy without Tolkien and his golden boy Aragorn leading the charge. But today I want to talk about something, or someone, just as influential. A series that helped shape the entire landscape of dark fantasy from Game of Thrones, The Witcher, and even Dark Souls. Now, I'm of course talking about the doomed albino soul-sucking sorcerer himself, Elric of Melniboné. If Tolkien gave us our first ever bender of high fantasy, well, it's safe to say Elric gave us The Hangover. He's the blueprint for the brooding anti-hero, the cursed protagonist, and yes, even the multiverse itself. And yet, somehow, despite influencing basically everything, Elric has kind of faded from the conversation. So today we're trying to fix that, and we're talking about what this series is, its wild history over the years, and where it even stands in the modern day. So grab your soul-stealing swords, summon your chaos patron gods, and let's explore whatever happened to Elric of Melniboné. Hey everyone, my name is Otto, and welcome to Exits Examines. In this channel, we'll be exploring series, franchises, and more after their prime time has seemingly come to an end. If that sounds good to you, there is a like and subscribe button below, and as always, I want to give an enormous shout out to my patrons who keep this channel alive. Thank you. Elric of Melniboné is a fantasy series by Michael Moorcock that started in the 1960s. And to describe it properly, it's probably better to start with what it isn't. You know how in a lot of classic fantasy, your hero is some scrappy farm boy with mysterious parentage who, spoiler, is secretly the heir to a noble kingdom that's fallen on hard times. He goes on an epic quest, discovers his destiny, defeats ultimate evil, gets a hot elf girlfriend, and rides off into a golden sunset while the choir swells. So Elric takes that entire formula, punts it straight out the nearest window, and then sets the house on fire for good measure. And what makes this even more fascinating is that Elric wasn't even made from fantasy tropes because it pretty much predated them. Moorcock wasn't tearing down cliches that already existed, he was inventing the counterpoint and rebuttal to the likes of Conan and Lord of the Rings before the cliches had even solidified. So our hero, if you can even call him that, which spoilers, probably not, is the exact opposite of your standard fantasy protagonist. Instead of being raised in generic fantasy village number 43 and slowly leveling up to become our king, Elric starts the story already on top. He's not just a ruler, he's an emperor, and not of some peaceful backwater kingdom either. His empire isn't under siege or decaying from the outside, they are the ones doing the conquering. For most of its history, Melniboné has been the threat. A civilization of cruel, decadent, hedonistic tyrants who see humans as little more than mildly interesting pets. These are not the good guys. They're not even the neutral guys. And to understand Elric, we first have to understand his people. Meet the Meliboneans, an ancient, storied race of people with a taste of drugs, slavery, and gruesome torture, living in the Dreaming City. But despite the name, this place is far from dreamy. And after centuries of conquering and pillaging the known world so hard, they got pretty bored of it slash transcended it. And now they spend their days wallowing in good old excess and hedonism. Their favorite pastimes include mutilating slaves with surgical precision until they can only sing one hauntingly beautiful note, or getting high as f- while drifting in dreamlike trances for days. And these are really interesting because they're magical trances where they learn sorcery, make pacts with demons and elemental beings, and other terrible things, and sometimes just simply never wake up. Now, I always kind of got the vibe that these were kind of like dark elves, ancient, reclusive, obsessed with pain and pleasure, but actually, apparently they're a bit more linked to dragons, and apparently they even used to lay eggs, so Barsoom, anyone? Now, all of this is possible because Melniboné sits on an almost unassailable island. Even if someone is insane enough to try to sail there, they would first have to navigate this ancient labyrinth harbor system, a deadly maze that only the locals fully understand, which is such a fascinating and unique concept, which is the first of many in here. Regardless, if you somehow do make it through, well, welcome to the party. You'll be greeted by one of the most terrifying naval fleets in the world, and oh yeah, dragons for good measure, just in case they weren't overpowered enough as is. And yet, despite all of these terrifying defenses, armies from the rest of the human world, dismissed by the Melniboneans as the so-called Young Kingdoms, keep trying to take them down. Why? Because that's how much the rest of the world hates them and thinks they're a blight to the world. After all, they kind of encapsulate the banality of evil and hedonism taken to absurd extremes. And the leader of this terrifying, monstrous, and arguably vapid race? Well, none other than the hero of our story, Elric. Elric is a man of many names. The Pale Prince of Ruins, the White Wolf, Elric Womanslayer, Elric Kinslayer, and actually he's the slayer of many things. And Elric is exceptional for many reasons. Exceptionally looking, he's this pale albino figure with glowing red eyes. Quote, "He is the color of a bleached skull. His flesh and the long hair which flows below his shoulders is milk white. From the tapering, beautiful head stare two slanting eyes, crimson and moody." He's also exceptionally gifted, a sorcerer, a fighter, and a commander. And exceptionally, by his race's standards, he's actually not that bad. He's a bit of a philosopher and thinker, which is an extremely rare trait among his people. But don't for a moment think that means our boy is a good guy. And let's remember that the standard here for goodness in Melniboné is pretty much curved to oblivion. So, for example, in one of the chronologically first books, he watches someone tortured to death almost indifferently. Make no mistake, he is capable of extreme violence, addicted to drugs to survive because he's so physically frail, and has a thing for his cousin. Oh, and his patron and benefactor is none other than the Lord of Chaos. So, yeah, this is not exactly a white knight. But it's these contradictions, these moral gray zones, and constant internal conflict that make Elric so fascinating. He broods constantly, lamenting his fate, and doesn't want to be emperor. But when someone does try to take the throne, he brutally and relentlessly puts them down. Violence isn't his first choice, but once it starts, he feels the lust of battle. He hates authority, but he embodies it. He's brooding and nihilistic, but tries to do the right thing and is extraordinarily capable when he acts. And yet, he's a bit of an idiot sometimes. He oscillates between outwitting his opponents brilliantly and making completely boneheaded decisions, which, let's just say, leads to mildly bad consequences, not just for Elric, but pretty much the entire world. And I think it's really telling how in one of the first descriptions we get of Elric, the book straight up asks us, is he sane? Quote, "I am Elric, Emperor of Melniboné. Cursed be me, Elric of Melniboné." End quote. Then there's Stormbringer. Of course, we cannot talk about Elric without talking about Stormbringer, arguably one of the most legendary and terrifying weapons in all of fantasy. It empowers him, it enslaves him, and basically makes him both unstoppable and completely doomed. You know, one of Elric's most defining traits is how brooding and miserable he is. But honestly, maybe he'd be a bit less moody if he just got a good night's sleep. And that's where today's sponsor, Mantis Sleep, comes in. Now, I have been using their stuff for months, every single night, actually, and I can say with total honesty, it is the best sleep gear I have ever had. I 100% stand by their Manta Sleep Mask sounds. It's super comfortable and blocks out all of the light, and even has built-in Bluetooth speakers so you can fall asleep listening to white noise, music, or, you know, some good old Elric books if you feel like dreaming of our albino edgelord. They're fully adjustable, breathable, and doesn't press on your eyes at all. Seriously, once you try it, every other sleep mask will feel like a medieval torture device. If you want to take your sleep setup even further into god-tier territory, check out their white noise machine, which is small, sleek, and surprisingly powerful. Perfect if you live somewhere noisy or want to go on a three-day sleep bender like the Milimineans. I'm genuinely thrilled to be partnering with Manta Sleep because I actually love their stuff. I use it every night. So if you want to sleep better, dream deeper, and wake up feeling less like a cursed sorcerer, check out Manta Sleep through the link below. You actually get 10% off using code EXITSEXAMINED, and hey, you'll be helping directly support the channel. Okay, back to Elric. The relationship between Elric and Stormbringer is central. It's a partnership of power, destruction, and tragedy. The sword empowers Elric's frail physicality, but the cost is just a minor one of sucking the souls out of his victims he murders. Not to mention, the sword has a will of its own, with Elric constantly fighting against its impulse to kill everything around him. So yeah, if you think you have a toxic relationship, things could probably be much worse. And here's the crazy thing. This is all just the beginning. All of his looks, his moral ambiguity, his powers, his cursed sword, it's all just the setup. Because despite all the names and titles I've thrown at you, there's still one more title that defines him above all else. And that is the Eternal Champion. And to explain the Eternal Champion is, like with all things Elric, an entirely different and massive can of worms. Because what this means is that it's Elric's job, in the cosmic sense, to keep the universe itself from tearing apart. See, in Moorcock's multiverse, everything boils down to a single struggle. Law versus chaos. Two primal forces locked in eternal combat, neither truly good nor truly evil. Law brings order, structure, and predictability, while chaos brings freedom, creativity, and destruction. Again, this is not good versus evil, it's more just each side has its own goals, and too much of either is probably pretty catastrophic for your average Joe. Fascinatingly enough, there are lords of chaos and lords of law that are not just abstract forces. They are real and tangible, but can't manifest in the mortal world unless summoned, but they're always watching and absolutely terrified. Now, Elric's own manipulative patron is, can you guess it? That's right, the Lord of Chaos, and his description changes. So the first time we meet him, chronologically anyway, he starts as a fly and then changes to this eerily beautiful young but old man. And then later, in another world, Elric thinks he sees his true form as this revolting thing. But regardless of looks, he loves Elric, cruelly, playfully, and helps him, occasionally anyway, but of course always at a cost, with Elric, for his part, only wanting to use the power of chaos for his own ends. So if you're keeping track here, this is toxic relationship number two. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. The point I want to make is that the thing that is holding all this together is balance. And that's where Elric and all the incarnations of the Eternal Champion come in. But here's the thing, because there's another thing. There's not just one of him. There's an entire web of universes, each with their own iteration of the champion. So, thus the eternal part, not in the sense of living forever, but existing everywhere, in every version of reality, endlessly repeating the same cosmic struggle under different masks. And you can start to see why these books get so dense. So, tying this back to Elric, Elric's story doesn't just happen in one world, it happens in all of them, across countless planes of existence. The Eternal Champions reappear again and again. In some reality, he fights for law, in others, he fights for chaos, and sometimes he just destroys everything because that's what the balance demands. You know, just another day in the office, am I right? Fascinatingly enough, Moorcock himself was pretty much the guy who invented the modern idea of the multiverse. His take on it still feels radical, because it's not just flavor text. In one of the books, The Sailors on the Seas of Fate, Elric literally sails into other dimensions and meets other versions of the champion, so different incarnations of himself from parallel worlds. And in this really dreamy sequence, some of them actually recognize Elric, remembering meetings that he himself hasn't had yet in his timeline. So again, all of this past, present, and future are overlapping. And in fact, at one point, Elric even brushes against our own world, meeting figures from Earth's distant future. And it all gives this very dreamlike, Odyssey-esque journey that's kind of surreal and disorienting at times, but it's still so fascinating. And despite multiverses as a concept becoming more and more common, I still haven't come across anything else quite like the one in Elric. And the more you think about it, the more horrifying the whole Eternal Champion thing actually is. Because what sounds like some grand cosmic destiny, you know, keep the balance of the universe, is, when you zoom in, an eternal curse. Just endless reincarnations of the same doomed struggle over and over again across infinite worlds. Elric, and every version of him across the multiverse, is trapped in this endless cycle of fighting, destroying, and questioning that never truly ends. Sometimes he fights for law, sometimes for chaos, sometimes against both, but even when he does win, it's temporary. Balance is restored, only for the wheel to start spinning again. And to make this even worse, he's pretty much a self-aware pawn. He can't even rebel because rebellion itself is part of the balance. It's tragedy on a cosmic level and kind of reads like some type of Shakespearean apocalypse of fantasy, which honestly, again, is such a cool and unique way to describe a fantasy series. And in a beautiful way, that ties into why Elric is so brooding. But despite the hopelessness, despite the sheer number of things above him pulling his strings, Elric still struggles, and he still tries to do what, in his mind, is right. Quote, "If you are asking, would I rather be myself or thyself, I must still say that I would be myself. For perpetual chaos must be as tedious as perpetual law or any other constant, a kind death. I believe I still have more to relish of the multiverse than hast thou, Sir Demon. I still live, I am still of the living." End quote. So taking a step back, I've been kind of being vague about the plots because at its core, Elric isn't just one clean story. It's kind of a fever dream made of fragments. Originally, they were published as pulp novellas, and with the saga unfolding out of order, with some overarching plot lines and reoccurring figures, sure, but the whole thing kind of feels like drifting through someone else's nightmare. But fine, you want the plots? Of course you do. Fine, I'll tell you, but just be warned, story spoilers for the next section to the timestamp. So, as we established, Elric starts as the albino emperor of a dying empire, frail, philosophical, and just slightly allergic to his own civilization's cruelty. His cousin, Yurkun, stages a coup, tries to marry Elric's cousin, and his sister, which, Jesus, how much incest can be in one family, but regardless, Elric eventually defeats him. Now, Elric, being Elric, and this is what I mean by him being an absolute dummy, decides, the best way I can punish my obviously evil and scheming cousin of mine, I know, I'll make him a regent of my empire while I essentially roam around the world doing whatever I want. So, Elric spends a while wandering the multiverse in what can only be described as an existential gap year. He meets his best friend Moonglum, a roguish thief who can't figure out how a perpetually miserable albino still gets more dates than him, has run-ins with a few other Eternal Champions, and also managed to anger a few sorcerers along the way. He also chats with the ghost of his dad because this series really can't resist a bit more Shakespearean references, aka Hamlet. Eventually, the plot does move forward when, to absolutely no one's surprise, aside from maybe Elric, Yurkun tries to steal his empire again. Elric becomes a very angry boy, so angry in fact that he accidentally destroys his entire empire. Also, kills his true love and Yurkun in the process, and somehow, that's still not the most depressing book in the series. Because the ending, Stormbringer, is likely one of the darkest, most insanely over-the-top end-of-everything books I've ever read. The final story takes that creeping despair that's been building throughout the entire series and detonates it. The literal start is with Elric leading the forces of good versus evil. And yeah, the good side loses catastrophically, with his patron queen herself getting torn apart in the aftermath, with chaos running wild. And that is just the start of the book, with somehow even more cataclysmic and end all everything battles to come. Elric's last act is to call upon Stormbringer one final time, and of course, the sword betrays him, kills his last friend, drinks Elric's own soul, and then laughs, literally laughs, as it escapes into the void. Farewell, friend. I was 1,000 times more evil than thou. End quote. And that's it. That's the end of the story. It's one of the most bleakest, most apocalyptic endings in fantasy. And sure, you know, some books leave you feeling hollow at the end, but geez, this really makes you feel hollow at the end. And if all of that sounds like nothing else in fantasy, that's because the guy who wrote it is unlike almost any other fantasy writer. Michael Moorcock was in his early 20s when he started writing Elric, and we have to remember that this was 1961. Epic fantasy as we know it basically didn't exist yet. This was just a few years after The Lord of the Rings first came out. And Moorcock himself is fascinating. He's been a musician, an editor, a journalist, and still found time to write dozens of novels in a weekend. And I'm not exaggerating by much. He used to knock out entire books in under a week. It's absurd. But despite the short writing times, his work is deeply personal, political, and philosophical. Quote, "I am an anarchist and a pragmatist. My books often end by saying, serve neither gods nor masters, be your own." End quote. But despite all that, Elric never feels like a manifesto. There's a raw bluntness to it, and Moorcock once said that he was writing primarily for the 18-year-old version of himself, and if he ever stopped doing that, he'd be betraying himself. Which is fitting, because Moorcock actually said that Elric is based on a younger version of himself. Quote, "Elric was me, and the mingled qualities of the betrayer and the betrayed, the bewilderment about life, the expressions of this bewilderment in terms of violence, cynicism, and revenge, those were all mine." End quote. There's also a Freudian edge running through it all. Moorcock once called Elric one of the most pornographic characters he ever wrote, and well, it is a story about a man trying to rein in the urges of his sword. But of course, there was a mix of influences. Moorcock was also obsessed with Lord Byron, Young, and classic pulp from the likes of Burroughs, so think Tarzan and Barsoom. Which is fascinating because Elric himself actually started as a request for a Conan-style pulp hero. The publisher basically asked Moorcock to give us something like Conan the Barbarian, and Moorcock did, but also somehow Conan's complete opposite. Instead of a strong, lusty barbarian who loves life, Elric is a frail, brooding philosopher who questions everything. He still goes on adventures, sure, gets with girls, sure, but also the complete and polar opposite of Conan on some fundamental levels. And not to sound too haughty here, but in this vein, you can tell Moorcock was being extremely purposeful and demonstrating a true understanding of the fantasy genre before the fantasy genre was even a thing. He once said that the reason he loved writing fantasy because it was only in that genre where forces like order and chaos could exist as literal, tangible, real forces. So again, using fantasy intentionally as a scalpel for his ideas. And it's just wild because that combined with the multiverse, the anti-hero prototype, law versus chaos, any one of these ideas could have and arguably should have been their own story, which brings us to probably one of the biggest criticisms people have about Elric, which is Moorcock's writing. Now, this can be a taste thing, but it can be rough. Moorcock famously called himself a bad writer with good ideas, which honestly might have doomed him a little bit. The adventures move at breakneck speed, and the sentences can get awkward, and things happen so fast where moments that should devastate you just kind of fly by before you can even register them. The prose isn't flowery or poetic, it's blunt and utilitarian like a well-worn tool that he's swinging around to get the job done. Personally, I don't think it's a bad thing. The lack of polish gives the Elric stories this raw, feverish energy that fits the world perfectly, and sometimes the writing even hits this strange, dreamy, almost mythic rhythm. And I actually kind of love how short and self-contained and to the point the stories are, but I also totally understand that it's not everyone's cup of tea. Still, I really do think that Moorcock cursed himself with that quote saying that he's a bad writer with good ideas because people repeat it constantly. And I can't help but wonder how differently his work would have been perceived if he had never said that in the first place. But whether you think it's well written or not, it's impossible to deny that these books were hugely, and I mean hugely, influential on modern fantasy. Even if you've never heard of Moorcock or Elric, his fingerprints are everywhere. You can draw a straight line from the brooding albino emperor to some of the biggest fantasy icons of our age. And let's start with The Witcher. The debate over whether Geralt was inspired by Elric has been raging for years. And yeah, it's been beaten to death on the internet. But if you're unaware, let's just name a few. White hair? Check. Monster hunter? Check. Using potions? Check. Literally named the White Wolf, the conjoining of spears, check and check. And no matter what side of the Witcher versus Elric debate you're on, that's just one of many. Warhammer directly took Moorcock's symbols for law and chaos, which I had no idea, but yeah, Moorcock literally invented the chaos sign. But no time to stop, because we also got Final Fantasy's obsession with tragic heroes, impossible destinies, and cosmic battles, Dark Souls with its decaying worlds and cycles of light and dark, and of course, A Song of Ice and Fire, with George R.R. Martin's silver-haired dragon lords with god complexes and incestuous bloodlines bearing a striking resemblance to the Meliboeans. And there's even a Stormbringer reference in the show when Joffrey's deciding names for his sword. And despite Elric never really being an anti-hero to Moorcock, instead just referring to him as a regular hero, for better or worse, Elric was the proto-dark fantasy anti-hero that has gone on to be a template for that trope. So let's move on to the no less confusing topic of what actually makes up the Elric series. And I think it's safe to say that between the multiverse shenanigans, Moorcock's unique approach to storytelling, and a metric ton of reprints, we are in for it. So strap the because this is going to get messy fast. Unpacking what actually counts as the Elric saga is like trying to assemble IKEA furniture using pages from 10 different instruction manuals, because the problem is threefold. One, the whole multiverse chaos, where Elric is literally popping in and out of worlds and times. Number two, the stories start as novellas and pulp shorts, not as a neatly planned series. And three, Moorcock straight up said there's no correct order. In fact, if you look at chronological order on Wiki, some of them just straight up say IDK. So just to give you an idea of how absurd this gets, Elric of Melniboné is technically the first story chronologically, but it came out after Stormbringer, which is basically his finale. Meanwhile, Elric's very first appearance was in the Dreaming City, which doesn't even happen until a few books into his timeline. Okay, reining this in, let's start with the basics. If you're counting everything, there are over 30 Elric stories starting in 1961. Most of these, as we talked about, were short pulp-length tales, and these were written across literal decades. The ones most people usually mean when they talk about the Elric books are mostly from the 60s and 70s. But even when Moorcock wrote the be-all, end-all finale, surprise, he came back with more. So he would later go on to fill in the gaps with The Singing Citadel and The Sleeping Sorceress. And in 1972, he wrote a prequel to tell Elric's origin. And of course, because he couldn't let Elric rest, he brought him back again in the early 2000s with the Dream Quest trilogy, including The Dream Thief's Daughter, The Skraelene Tree, and The White Wolf's Son, with crossover to our world's World War II. So yes, if we're trying to examine what actually makes up the entire series in totality, this is pretty much the domain of chaos. Now, if you don't care about reading order or the labyrinth of publication history, you can safely skip ahead to the adaptation section before I start losing my mind. But if you do care, all of this is only half of it, because this series has been printed, reprinted, renamed, and reshuffled more times than the multiverse itself. So, basically, because all of those 30 short stories were, you know, short stories, over the years, they've inevitably been turned into collections, which should make things simple, right? After all, that is what collections are for. Well, apparently not, because the problem here is that there have been so many different collections, all slightly different in order, slightly different versions, edits, or changes. And then you've got American versus UK, retitles, reprints, and special editions. And it all gets very confusing very quickly. Especially because the series never really ended. Moorcock has just kept writing new Elric stuff all over the decades, and every new edition tries to reorganize it differently. Now, there are a ton of collections and editions I could rattle off, but for brevity's sake, a few of the most prominent ones over the years have been the DAW editions in the 70s, and these were iconic for the Michael Whelan cover art. Then in 1990s, there was Orion Publishing, which released a two-book collection, Elric of Melniboné and Stormbringer, which really streamlined things a bit. Most recently, the most well-known is Saga Press in 2022, which is a four-volume collection of Elric stories and probably what you're most commonly going to see floating around today. The first two volumes are the exact same as the Orion. If you're seeing Elric audiobooks or digital editions on Spotify, they're probably going off the Saga Press, which loosely follows a chronological structure. Speaking of that, if you want to read all of these in chronological order, all I can say is you're pretty much actually, it's not that bad. You could just follow one of the collections. But the problem is a lot of the stories are pretty much up to interpretation on where they fit in the timeline. Now, if you want the closest thing to like a version with an actual beginning, middle, and end, the order you're probably going to see is this. Number one, Elric of Melniboné. Two, The Sailors on the Seas of Fate. Three, The Weird of the White Wolf. Four, The Banishing Tower. Five, The Bane of the Black Sword. And finally, Stormbringer, which gives it a pretty definitive ending. But not really, because remember the whole multiverse thing I talked about? We have to remember that there's other Eternal Champions, and Moorcock, the Mad Lad, wrote entire separate series for many of these characters too. So some of these other characters that have spawned their own long-running series have been Coram, who is the champion with the silver hand, basically Elric's spiritual twin, a tragic fae-like hero whose entire race gets wiped out by humans. Also John Dacre, one who's cheerfully forced to remember all of his other lives as the Eternal Champion, so understandably doesn't really have all of his marbles together. We also got Dorian Hawkmoon, who lives in a post-apocalyptic pseudo-fantasy Europe where an insane version of Britain has taken over the world. It's part sci-fi, part sword and sorcery. And that's not even to mention the Zynite and the whole detective slash Von Bach elements, which I just cannot get into for the sake of brevity for this video. So if you're truly depraved, you can try reading everything, aka all of these stories, in chronological order. And if you do, I absolutely salute you, and I've included a guide with an incredible spreadsheet to help you sort through the madness in the description below. Now, for a character as influential and long-lasting as Elric, you would think that he would have a lot of adaptations. Elric's record, on the other hand, is a patchwork of brilliant highs and very cursed dead ends. But let's start with a bright spot, because if there's one medium where he actually thrived, it's comics. Pretty much every major publisher has taken a swing at adapting Elric at some points, and to wildly different results. The first Elric comics started appearing as early as the 1960s, and Moorcock himself often had a hand in the writing, which definitely helped keep the tone sharp and strange in the best way possible. One of the earliest standouts was the 1973 black and white run from Vault Comics by Stephen Grant, and for such an early edition was chock full of graphic violence and full nudity, so definitely on brand for the series. Then came the Marvel era in the early 80s, when Conan the Barbarian legend Roy Thomas took a crack at Elric. It's stylized, moody, and surprisingly faithful. And of course, there was a Conan the Barbarian crossover, which is really fun to see both of them on the same page. We also got Pacific Comics' 1983 six-issue run, which leaned more into cartoonish caricature. Think Saturday morning villain Raccoon, fun but tonally all over the place. There's even some production errors with pages out of order, something that they would acknowledge in later printings. After that, Elric continued to bounce around publishers, with a few notable ones being First Comics in 1985, Dark Horse starting in 1997, and even DC Comics having a swing in the early 2000s. And you could pretty much go on and on with these, with Boom Studios taking a run in 2011, which reimagined a modern-day Elric in an alternate timeline, and other versions cropping up all over the place, including some in Heavy Metal magazine. But finally, we got what many fans, including Moorcock himself, consider the best of the bunch, Titan slash Glenay Comics. Now, these are absolutely stunning and were described by Moorcock as, quote, the first to truly capture the sense of utter decadence he intended for the novels. They're grotesque, haunting, and absolutely gorgeous. And if you want to see Elric at his most visually powerful, this is probably where to start. It's honestly kind of fascinating how every era reimagines him differently. Sometimes he's brooding and tragic, sometimes sleek and heroic, sometimes he's looking like he wandered off a prog rock album cover. And it's been great there's been so many comic adaptations and new ones are still popping up, because as for the other avenues of Elric adaptations, well, they've been lacking to say the least. So this is the part where I'd normally say, and then came the blockbuster adaptation, but there is just not one. Now, that's not to say there hasn't been any attempt over the decades, but none of them have made it past development hell. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, Wendy Pinney, co-creator of ElfQuest, tried to turn Elric into an animated film. She even published a book about the process called Law and Chaos, the Stormbringer Animated Film Project. It's full of concept art, sketches, and story ideas, and honestly, it's gorgeous. Unfortunately, the project never happened, which is a shame because judging by her notes, it would have been something truly striking. Fast forward to 2007, when there was an announcement that there would be an adaptation of a trilogy of Elric movies for Universal Pictures from the same directors from American Pie and Golden Compass. They even got as far as writing what they described as a very edgy script, and this was reportedly still being talked about in 2012, but again, nothing ever came from it. Now, there's been a bit more movement on the TV side. In 2019, New Republic Pictures acquired the rights to the Elric saga, which sounded promising, but like with so many other projects before it, everything went quiet after the initial announcement. Moorcock himself has been very protective of the rights, especially after seeing what Hollywood has done with other dark fantasy properties. Quote, heard today that some companies are turning down Elric because it reminds them too much of Game of Thrones and The Witcher. Pretty ironic. End quote. Still, if there's ever a fantasy anti-hero who deserves his time on screen, it's Elric. So hopefully one day something will come of it. And you would think that Elric would be a no-brainer for video games, right? A brooding anti-hero wandering between worlds, stealing souls with a cursed sword that has dark fantasy RPG written all over it. And yet, again, there's been nothing, but it wasn't for lack of trying. In the late 90s, Haiku Studios started developing an Elric game for the original PlayStation, and it was supposed to be a 3D action adventure based on the early books. Unfortunately, it never really got past the prototype stage. And then, in 2021, Swedish developer Runeterra announced they'd acquired the rights to make a narrative action game based on the first novels, and even better, Moorcock himself was involved in the development, and he sounded genuinely excited, saying, quote, for many years I have looked forward to seeing Elric translated into a state-of-the-art video game, and at last it looks as if Runeterra are going to bring that dream to fruition. The game was supposed to release in 2024, and I hate to break it to you, but it's past that date. Nothing surfaced, no trailer, no screenshots, not even a teaser logo. And it really is starting to feel like a curse. If you ever announce an Elric adaptation, it simply ceases to exist afterward. Which is a shame because Elric is made for gaming. You could easily imagine a Souls-like where every swing of Stormbringer drains souls and brings back some health. But alas, no matter how much The Witcher and Game of Thrones may have borrowed from him, Elric himself still hasn't gotten his own game. Okay, so the screen and console gods may have forsaken Elric, but at least the dice gods have shown him some love, because Elric has had a long and surprisingly rich history in the world of tabletop gaming. Actually, interestingly enough, in the early days of Dungeons & Dragons, Elric and Stormbringer both popped up in one of the D&D books. Specifically, the 1976 supplements of Gods, Demigods, and Heroes, and even got name-dropped again in AD&D 2nd Edition. The real landmark came with Chaosium's Stormbringer RPG. Set in the Young Kingdoms, it lets you wander around the world that is perpetually 10 years away from total annihilation. The game ran for 5 editions across multiple decades, and this was a big push with adventures, supplements, and more. And in fact, it's still running. The mechanics are pretty simple but elegant, and the games were approved by Moorcock himself. Even today, Stormbringer has a devoted following, and there's a great website, stormbringerrpg.com, which is a great resource for it. Chaosium actually made a board game too. Well, actually, two. Elric and Elric Battle at the End of Time, which are war games. Although I could find screenshots of the first version Elric from 1977, I could find no videos or other info on this, so if anyone has played these or has other info on them, I would love to hear more about them. But actually, we aren't done with the TTRPGs, because the license eventually shifted to Mongoose Publishing, which released Elric of Melibane in 2007 under their RuneQuest system. Perception has been a bit mixed. Some people love the fresh mechanical take, others preferred the previous RPG. But at the very least, it kept Elric's legacy alive. In the early 2000s, we also got Dragon Lords of Melniboné, a short-lived D&D 3rd edition adaptation, which apparently was not so great. Now, most recently, we got, or almost got, Elric Rise of the Young Kingdoms, which seems to be a bit of a mess now. Now, seemingly this was supposed to be a semi-cooperative board game that promised players the chance to battle, scheme, and summon gods across the Doom world. It launched on Kickstarter to solid buzz, and then things went sideways. The developers kept pushing back release dates, communications got spotty, and eventually they admitted on Facebook that they, quote, bit off more than they could chew. Now, they insisted that the game would still exist eventually, but as of now, it's still in limbo. The last update I could find on Facebook basically says it was pushing it back again and just saying sorry, so the jury is still out, so it could be a scam. Again, if someone has more info on this, I'd love to know more about it, and it's a shame because it actually did look like it had a lot of good production value. Now, we actually still aren't done with the adaptations because there was a wild amount of music inspired by Elric. For a brooding albino sorcerer from the 60s, he's got some serious rock cred. First off, Moorcock himself made music. He actually had his own band called Michael Moorcock and the Deep Fix, so that's pretty cool. But the most famous collaboration came from a totally different direction, the Blue Oyster Cult. Turns out Moorcock was staying at the same hotel as the band back in the day, and they met, hit it off, and the next thing you know, he's writing lyrics for them. He wrote a few of their tracks, one of which, The Black Blade, was a straight-up homage to Elric's cursed Stormbreaker. And it even includes lines from the sword's perspective. Moorcock himself even performed live with Blue Oyster Cult at Dragon Con in 1987, which is pretty cool again. Another one, Hawkwind, is also worth a minch. Their Chronicles of the Black Sword is an adaptation of Elric, and their Live Chronicles album includes Moorcock doing some monologues in between some of the tracks. And if anyone's curious, I'll link an entire playlist of Elric-inspired songs on Spotify in the description below if you're looking for a playlist to pregame stealing some souls to. Okay, so all of that being said, where does that leave Elric in the cold, sobering light of the modern day? Well, the series technically wrapped up ages ago, but Moorcock keeps circling back. In fact, in 2022, he dropped a pretty substantial book, The Citadel of Forgotten Myths, which has a ton in here and is really well done, with a lot of classic adventures of Elric and Moonglum, and slots in right before Stormbringer. It's a full-on return to classic Elric. Even more recently, The Folk of the Forest in 2023 was a new short Elric story with some illustrations. So yeah, Moorcock has been writing Elric stories for over 60 years, which is wild to think about. In interviews, Moorcock said he doesn't really plan to write any new novels anymore, just occasional short stories when inspiration hits. And there are rumors of new Elric-adjacent materials in the pipeline. Moorcock's even joked about how he has 8 books rattling around in his head at any given time, which is honestly kind of beautiful. And it's not just the books, the comics are still going on too. And for a doomed anti-hero that was supposed to end in the 60s, Elric is doing suspiciously well. Even if he's not necessarily riding on top of the wave of popular modern zeitgeist, that is not to say Elric is not well known, and you get the impression that the fandom is small but extremely dedicated, and those that know, know. You can see it bubbling up all the time online. YouTubers making deep dives, incredible fan art all over the place, a Reddit community, that's not even to mention the Stormbringer and TTRPG community, which is still going pretty strong. And large communities of Elric fans have popped up all over the world, notably in France and Japan. Now, unfortunately, it's not all good news. There was a tragic event in the fandom when the primary Moorcock fan site was taken down from the internet just a few months ago for unknown reasons, which is a shame because it was a great place for info. But despite this small but dedicated fandom, it makes you wonder, why isn't Elric more popular today? Why did he fade into cult status instead of becoming a household name like The Witcher or Game of Thrones? After all, he did inspire them, which is kind of annoying that Elric doesn't get his due. Now, my best guess, and this is pure speculation, is that Elric was the rough iron prototype for dark fantasy. At times, it's messy, raw, and unpolished in the best possible way. This was before the genre had a template, before we figured out the pacing and the tropes that modern fantasy thrives on. My guess is that to modern readers, Elric just isn't as streamlined or accessible. It's strange, fragmented, philosophical, and kind of exhausting. But that's what makes it special. And you know the saying that imitation is the best form of flattery. The idea of the tortured antihero, the tragic chosen one, the moral grayness, and the concept of the multiverse itself all traces directly back to Moorcock. He didn't just influence dark fantasy, he practically invented a good part of it. So, whether or not Elric never gets a huge adaptation or blows up in the popular fantasy landscape, it doesn't really matter. Because well known or not, Elric has radically, irreversibly, and completely changed the shape of the modern fantasy landscape. So, in conclusion, no matter which multiverse you're in, never try to navigate the Millimnaean labyrinth without a local guide, and always strive for balance between order and chaos,
even if you don't have a soul-sucking sword on your hip.
I want to give an enormous shout out to the Wise Veterinarian for helping me fact check.
I also want to give another huge shout out to Zarar Kuru for helping me fact check. And another shout out to the Lawful Stupid RPG channel, who also helped me tremendously with fact checking. And they're running Dark Sun at the moment, if you want to see some Dark Sun chaos.
As well as the many other people on the Elric Reddit who also helped me fact check and bounce ideas off of. As always, I want to give a huge, huge, huge shout out to my patrons who keep this channel alive and running. You guys are my Stormbringer, although slightly less toxic. As always, if you ever have any suggestions about what you want me to cover next on the channel, please drop a comment and let me know. I think I covered Elric because so many people mentioned it. Anyway, thank you so much again. I hope you have a great day, and I'll see you next time. Bye.